A group of Israeli settlers stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds ahead of a planned flag march that has drawn warnings from Palestinians. Iran calls on Turkey to respect Syria's sovereignty after Ankara threatens to launch a new offensive to create a so-called safe zone in the border area. Fierce fighting is reported in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces have intensified their attacks to capture more areas. Hello and welcome to World News, broadcast from our Tehran studios with me, Behruz Najafi. Now, beginning with Palestine, the city of Al-Quds is on edge. Dozens of Israeli settlers protected by forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound ahead of a controversial flag march. Settlers waved Israeli flags as they crossed the Damascus Gate and marched through Al-Quds' old city. They assaulted and beat up three Palestinians, causing them minor injuries. One of them was moved to the hospital for treatment. Several Palestinians were also arrested after Israeli forces attacked worshippers inside Al-Aqsa. Since early this morning, the Israeli military has restricted Palestinians' access to Al-Aqsa. Despite that, hundreds of worshippers have already gathered inside and outside the compound. The latest developments come as thousands of Israeli settlers are preparing to hold the controversial flag march. Now, that marks the anniversary of Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967. Different Palestinian groups, including Hamas, have warned of consequences if Israel fails to change the planned route and tries to approach Al-Aqsa. But Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett says that the march will proceed along the planned route. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Akandil tells us about the current security situation in Al-Quds.
Clashes took place inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque while Israeli forces firing heavy tear gas against the Palestinian protesters and the Palestinian worshippers. Palestinians had nothing inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque but stones to throw at the Israeli forces and the Israeli settlers in order to prevent the raid to continue taking place. The first raid to the Al-Aqsa Mosque started at 7 o'clock in the morning, local time. There would be another incursion to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex after almost 2 hours from now. This would be in preparation for the major march that is known as the Flag March, where thousands of Israeli settlers are expected to take part in this march under the protection of Israeli forces. The real challenge now is that the Palestinian resistance groups and the Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime not to allow the settlers to raid the mosque during the flag march and not to lift or raise the Israeli flag, and warned them also not to allow the Israeli settlers from touring inside the Muslim quarter of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the narrow streets of Al-Quds, this part where Palestinian Muslims live there. But the settlers have the green light to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and raise the Israeli flag during the flag march.
A high-ranking Israeli official has visited Saudi Arabia and met with senior Saudi officials, fueling speculation that the two sides could be taking reciprocal steps toward the normalization of the relations. But this is not a first contact of its kind. It's an open secret that Riyadh and Tel Aviv have had an unofficial behind-the-scenes relationship and have even coordinated security-related issues in the past.
A senior Israeli official has travelled to the Saudi capital and met inside the royal palace with a high-ranking Saudi official. According to Israel's Channel 12, the visit was meant to coordinate security cooperation between the two sides, which included the alleged common threats posed by Iran. The visit was linked to the two sides' mutual interest in leveling up their relations. In March, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said, "Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy, but looks to it as a potential ally," saying they have many interests that can pursue together. Riyadh and Tel Aviv have no formal diplomatic relations, although it is widely believed that they do have contacts behind the scenes. There are plenty of examples of this. In 2018, it was reported that the chief of staff of the Israeli army met his Saudi counterpart to discuss terrorism and the alleged threat from Iran. Saudi Arabia's decision to allow Air India flights to and from Tel Aviv to transit through Saudi airspace are tangible signs of a shift. When bin Salman was asked about Israel having a say on a stolen Palestinian land, he said he believes that the Jewish people have a right to a nation-state in at least part of their ancestral homeland. U.S. President Joe Biden is going to travel to the occupied Palestinian territories. Biden administration officials are in talks with the Saudis about arranging a potential in-person meeting between Biden and the Saudi prince for the first time. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's advisor Eyal Hulata is expected to travel to the U.S. next week. Earlier this week, two senior U.S. officials reportedly visited Riyadh as the Biden administration is quietly mediating a Red Sea deal between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt that involves the transfer of two strategic islands, Tiran and Sanafir, in the Red Sea from Egyptian to Saudi sovereignty with Israeli consent. The deal could also pave the way for the official announcement of the normalization of ties between Riyadh and Tel Aviv. When asked about the report, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan refused to deny it, only saying more steps needed to be taken to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2020, Israel's then Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Riyadh and met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This year saw Washington brokering normalization of relations between the Israeli regime and some Arab states, including United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia's key Arab allies in the region. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause.
Saudi Arabia, like other Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf, has kept its relationship with Israel under wraps for quite some time. The monarchy has not recognized Israel since its occupation of Palestinian land in 1948. And traditionally, Riyadh's official policy toward the Middle East conflict has been supportive of Palestinian Arabs and against Israel. But just like any other Persian Gulf Arab state, Saudi Arabia has failed to take any actual steps that would promote the cause of Palestine.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have for years been conducting covert talks on diplomatic, security, and business affairs, and now Washington is trying to improve ties with Riyadh. U.S. officials are even seeking to organize a meeting between Biden and the Saudi crown prince. This comes against the backdrop of the global energy crisis caused by the war in Ukraine. Russia-Ukraine conflict continues to rock the global energy market. The U.S. is finding itself increasingly reliant on Saudi Arabia, the world's largest crude oil exporter.
A Zionist entity like Israel, I can't really call them a country because they're not. Palestine is the legitimate country. Israel has usurped and stolen the land. So I would caution any nation. I look at what Israel has done to the United States, how they have infiltrated and used the Jewish population in the U.S. to influence our foreign policy in a manner that is no longer favorable to the American people, but instead is favorable to the government of Israel.
Saudi Arabia has refrained from normalizing ties with Israel, unlike Bahrain and UAE, saying it would not do so without a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But bin Salman calling Tel Aviv a potential ally could indicate that Riyadh has already betrayed the Palestinian cause, and admitting it overtly is only a matter of time.
In other news, Iran calling on Turkey to respect Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and that after Ankara announced plans for a new military operation in the Arab country. Foreign Ministry spokesman says Tehran is opposed to any recourse to military action and use of force to resolve disputes. According to Said Khatibzadeh, such measures violate the sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries and only complicate the situation. He said that Iran understands Turkey's security concerns, but the only way to address those concerns is via dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with neighbors. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan has threatened to launch a new military operation in Syria to create what he calls a safe zone in the border area. Well, I had a conversation with author and commentator John Stepling, and he blames the U.S. and NATO's provocations for unrest across the world, including on the Turkey-Syria border.
The Syrian situation, the incursions into Syria, are something that have happened over the last 6, 7, 8 years. I mean, it's been a source of unease and anger on the part of Erdogan and Turkey, and they do have some concerns with the stability or security in the south with the Kurds. But, you know, this is all, I mean, if you take all of this kind of incoherence and contradiction, you can lay it at the feet of U.S.-NATO provocation. I mean, that's really the problem here. These are the sources of global unrest right now in the most acute form is U.S. imperialist expansion in the form of NATO right to the borders of Russia, their open statement they want regime change in Moscow and so forth, just as they wanted regime change in Damascus. They've said they want Assad gone. This is the problem, is U.S., you know, American exceptionalism, this imperialist mindset that the U.S. can play the role of policeman to the planet and make the world safe for Western capital, Western business, and that's really the goal.
The Russian military is stepping up its campaign to take over the city of Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine. According to local officials, the city is under heavy shelling. No estimates available for the scale of damage or casualties from today's fighting. On Saturday, they said at least 2 people died and 13 buildings were destroyed. The Russian military says it's taking control of the nearby rail hub of Lyman and Donetsk, but according to Ukrainian officials, the city has not yet fallen. Moscow is pushing to seize the entire eastern regions of Donetsk and Lugansk, where it says it wants to protect the local pro-Russia population. It's also hitting areas farther away, including capital Kiev, with airstrikes. Okay, for an update on the latest on the ground there, let's go to Donetsk. Johnny Miller, our correspondent, is there and reporting things for us. Johnny, what's new?
Currently in the center of Donetsk. It's a lazy, warm Sunday afternoon here. And people are just walking around, strolling, playing with their families. The cafes are full. If you came to Donetsk not knowing there was a war on, you wouldn't believe that the front line is only 6 kilometers away, just on the outskirts of this city. When I first arrived here 2 weeks ago, you would hear the constant rumble and boom of outgoing and incoming artillery. But now, as you can hear, it's quite quiet. Although there is attacks during the night. One civilian was killed on the outskirts of town. The reason that it's much quieter here in the center of Donetsk at the moment is because of the Russian advances not far to the north of here, which are threatening the Ukrainian positions on the outskirts of town. President Zelensky says that it's hell and indescribably difficult for the Ukrainian forces in Donbass at the moment, which is in stark contrast to how placid it is here in Donetsk. This conflict is... While on one hand it's a proxy war between Russia and NATO, it's also a civil war and an ethno-cultural war. You ask most of the people around me here what they think of the separatists here in Donetsk and what they think of the Russian invasion. They'll tell you that they support the separatists and they support the Russian invasion. You ask people in Kiev the same question, they will tell you that the separatists are wrong and that they do not support, and that's putting it mildly, the Russian invasion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Johnny, from what's going on the ground, what are we expecting to happen in the coming days? Further attacks or maybe some calm?
Well, Russia's making serious advances. It's very difficult for us to get close to it because the Russians don't allow many journalists close to the actual fighting. But the Russians are making serious advances. They plan to take the whole of Donbass. It's difficult to see just how Ukraine and NATO, their NATO backers, are going to be able to support them, give them enough weapons, heavy weapons in time for them to stop Russia taking the rest of Donbass. And then there's a hope that Russia may well call an end to its special military operation, or maybe they might try to take other cities like Kharkiv and Odessa. But increasingly, there are some calls for negotiations and peace. France and Germany have been trying to put pressure on the Ukrainians and Russia in order to seek negotiations. But at the moment, the Ukrainians are saying they will not negotiate unless there's a precondition that Russia will give back all their territory that they took at the beginning of this conflict. And Russia is simply not going to do that. But there are increasing calls for negotiations, but particularly Russia at the moment when it is on the advance, are not negotiate either.
Okay, thanks for that. Jana Miller, our correspondent in Donetsk, Ukraine. Now, meantime, Russia says that the West is absolutely wrong in trying to link a global surge in food prices to the Ukraine war and Moscow's blockade of Ukrainian ports. The foreign ministry spokeswoman says the prices for agricultural products surged in 2020 when the COVID pandemic caused major disruptions to supply chains. According to Maria Zakharova, the Western sanctions on Russia are, in her words, the main catalyst for the existing negative trends. She also accused the United States and the EU of diverting some 20 million tons of Ukrainian grain meant for Africa and West Asia to warehouses in Europe. Zakharova also said that the U.S. is provoking a food crisis in Ukraine by depleting its grain reserves through a wheat-for-weapons scheme. Iran is observing a day of national mourning for victims of a building collapse in the southern city of Abadan. The government declared a national mourning to condole with the bereaved families there. 7 days after the incident, emergency crews are still at the site, clearing up the debris. Abadan's governor says another body has been dragged from under rubble, and that raised the number of confirmed deaths to 209. Rescue workers have also pulled dozens of people alive from the site. The unfinished Metropole building, located on Abadan's busiest street, crumbled last Monday, leaving dozens of people trapped in the ruins. Officials blame faulty construction practices for the incident. President Ebrahim Raisi has given assurances that whoever is responsible for the tragedy will be held accountable. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. has the most number of weapons, with an estimated 400 million guns in circulation. That's more guns than people in the United States, and almost half of the civilian-owned guns on the planet. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan writers. This article is published under the heading, Gun Massacres Are the Grotesque Pinnacle of American Exceptionalism. Here's the story. Together We Rise reads the motto on a wall of Robb Elementary School in Ovalle, Texas. The school serves about 600 students in the second through fourth grades. Over 90% are Latinx. 19 children between the ages of 9 and 11 and two of their teachers were murdered there recently, where an 18-year-old gunman armed with a semi-automatic AR-15 rifle. The shooter, Salvador Ramos, was killed at the school by a U.S. Border Patrol agent. At a news conference recently, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican who consistently rejects gun control, blamed the shortage of mental health services for the atrocity. Manny Oliver, whose son, Joaquin, was killed in the Parkland, Florida school massacre in 2018, said on the Democracy Now! News Hour, "This is not about mental health. That happens all around the planet. This is about guns and easy access to guns." In the middle of Governor Abbott's briefing, Beto O'Rourke, who is running against Abbott in the upcoming gubernatorial election, interrupted saying, "The time to stop the next shooting is right now, and you are doing nothing. You said this is not predictable. This is totally predictable." Others on the stage cursed at O'Rourke, demanding he leave as police closed in O'Rourke exited. His accusations were echoed in a tweet by Amanda Gorman, the youngest presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history, who wrote, "It takes a monster to kill children, but to watch monsters kill children again and again and do nothing isn't just insanity, it is inhumanity." Many U.S. politicians parrot the line that this is the greatest nation on earth. American exceptionalism is ingrained in the U.S. culture. Americans have the most number of weapons, with an estimated 400 million guns in circulation. That's more guns than people in the United States, and almost half of the civilian-owned guns on the planet. Americans are without question number one when it comes to mass shootings. The Gun Violence Archive has counted 213 so far this year alone, and more than 3,000 since 2014. A shocking number of U.S. mass shootings take place in schools. According to the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, there have been 2,054 school shootings in the United States since 1970, with 681 deaths. Canada has had a total of 8 school shootings in about the same time frame, from 1975, with a total of 31 victims killed. Mexico has had 17 school shootings since 2004, with 15 victims killed. In Australia in 1996, a young man with an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle massacred 35 people in the tourist town of Port Arthur, Tasmania. Australia is a country of gun lovers, but reaction to the shooting was swift, with a popular national mandatory gun buyback for semi-automatic guns. Some 643,000 guns were collected and destroyed. Since then, Australia has experienced just one mass shooting of the type that occurs almost daily in the U.S. Similar policies were established in other wealthy industrialized nations in the wake of mass shootings in Canada, New Zealand, the UK, and Norway. When access to guns is restricted and gun ownership is more difficult, gun violence dramatically drops. There is consensus on tightening gun laws in the United States. Preventing those suffering from mental illness from owning or accessing guns has between 85 to 90% bipartisan support, according to the Pew Research Center. Banning clips that hold more than 10 bullets has 64% bipartisan support. A federal database tracking every gun sale enjoys 66% support. Why won't elected officials heed the electorate? One clear reason is the decades of lobbying by the National Rifle Association. The American Gun Lobby, supported by American gun manufacturers, is alive and well. Robin Lloyd, managing director of GIFORTS, the organization dedicated to preventing gun violence led by former Congress member Gabby GIFORTS, who was shot in the head in a mass shooting in Tucson, said, "The National Rifle Association has been weakened by self-inflicted wounds of greed and mismanagement of funds. Another organization is the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which spends more on lobbying against gun violence prevention measures in Washington than NRA does. They are the true face of the American corporate gun lobby." Nicole Golden, executive director of Texas Gun Sense, organizes for Common Sense Gun Control in the Lone Star State. "I've been involved in gun violence prevention in Texas for almost a decade," she said on Democracy Now, adding, "our work has basically been shut down. Despite the power of the gun lobby, she's not without hope," saying, "we are here for the long haul. We're not going anywhere. We will keep chipping away, working in our communities to pass meaningful change and building this extremely strong movement. As the children of Robb Elementary School proclaim, together we rise."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and you're hearing me from the Viewpoints, in which we shall discuss some very controversial issues. Without further ado, I'd plunge into the heart of discussion. But before that, I would like our dear guests to introduce themselves to us. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. I'm Ali. Thanks for inviting me to your show.
The pleasure is all mine. And you?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I am Ruhullah Rouhani, and it's a pleasure to be in the service of you, inshallah, in this gathering.
Yes, and I'm glad to have you here. Well, death and the world surrounding it has always been a matter of questioning for too many people. Through history and from the old ages, people used to ask questions about the world to come, about the experiences that are going to happen after death. Now, some people during their lifetime have this chance to get to have some points, some touch of the other world. But when they come back and they explain about the experience they had, it's sort of unbelievable, and it's very hard to believe all what they discuss about. So this experience of going to another world, seeing some metaphysical things that maybe they exist right now, but we are unaware of them, is very difficult to understand. I would like you to help us understand this issue and the process of having these sort of experiences.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. As for your question, I have to say that the concept of death and also resurrection or going to the other world or passing this world and transferring to the other world has been among the inevitable questions and issues of all religions, namely Abrahamic religions. I said all religions, then accepted the Abrahamic religions to say that even other religions, up until the time that they have not been distorted, even it was a case, an issue of discussion and controversial issue among all Abrahamic and non-Abrahamic religions. So it's very interesting for people to know what is going to happen after they actually die, when they enter the Day of Judgment, and let's say...
Sorry to interrupt you, and I think it's because since it's the world of unknown, it's interesting for everyone to know what happens over there.
Definitely.
So I think that's why it's not related to religion or a special culture. Yeah. Everyone is interested to know what happened there.
Definitely. But I wanted to reach to this conclusion that later on in those distorted religions, those who faced problems with the ideology and worldview that they had with, they come to ignore this issue. So it is not more interesting for them, and they don't like to pay attention to that.
They ignore the afterlife?
The life after this life, yeah. Because a modern human is trying to forget what is going to happen after his death. And they sometimes come to nullify and to nullify all the theories have been said and mentioned, even whatever has been mentioned in the words of the scholars or the leaders of the religions. So this was the difference. I said that it was a case for the Abrahamic religion. Then, in case even other religions have not been distorted, it was also an interesting issue for them.
Yes.
So that's why I actually differentiated between these two. All in all, this is really interesting because we like to know what happens after we leave this world, to know what is going to happen there. And what is our situation like, whatever has been said and narrated is true or not, but there are even some ways to catch this information and to get to this information earlier, even before we die.
Yes, that's very true. So, and you, please, can you just give us a touch upon that issue?
First of all, let me look at this phenomenon from a philosophical perspective.
Yes.
You see, according to the Muslim philosophers, not only the Muslim philosophers, but also the ancient Greek philosophers, so the truth or the essence or the true nature of the human being is its soul, not the body.
Yes.
So soul is the exact or the true nature or the essence of human being.
Mm-hmm.
So this, when it comes to the soul and to the spirit, you can say, the soul is some immaterial kind of existence.
Just a question. Do yes. all people from all religion believe in the spirits and souls? Do they believe
I'm
that
I'm not sure about all religions, at least for Abrahamic religions, mm-hmm. we are sure that they do believe in this kind of phase of life where we can say transcendent kind of world. But when it comes to the Hinduism, I'm sure that, yeah, they do also believe these kind of things. But for the rest of religions, I have no idea, because I did not have any kind of status in this regard. So since soul is completely and perfectly a kind of immaterial existent, so it is possible for the soul to get extension from the body or from the limited kind of material things.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is even possible that the person can do it under his own control, because we've had kind of sort of mauti-ikhtiyari in the history of
they
the mysticism.
They go through some sessions, rituals.
Yeah, mystics or let's say these kind of people, they have had these kind of experiences that they can get, that they can extend or spread their soul
they
out.
They can
of,
travel to the metaphysics.
Of course, yeah, to experience or to perceive kind of immaterial realities.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to the possibility of this kind of experiences based on the teachings and doctrines of Islam, particularly from a mystic or philosophical perspective, it is quite possible. Mm-hmm. And there's no problem with it.
So now we're speaking of mysticism and philosophy. Now I wonder, scientific issues do not accept the spirits or the souls?
Why not? You know, we can provide...
I mean, has it been scientifically proved?
Of course, recently, if you search through the internet, you find lots of articles, essays, books that are written on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of physicians, doctors.
Exactly.
They did lots of projects researching on this idea, on these kind of issues. So since lots of people from different cultures, from different societies, countries, from different religions, they share these kind of experiences with the doctors, with the physicians. So that's why, since numberless people, we can say, from across the globe, they have had these sort of experiences, and they tell us about what they perceived in that kind of experiences. So it's a kind of pieces of evidence that prove the existence and the possibility of this.
It has been proved, because many of them have the same experience.
Of course,
I mean, some part of their experience are just alike.
Yeah, there are certain commonalities between mm-hmm. all these kind of experiences. So they have some shared and common kind of experiences. Mm-hmm. So when different people from different cultures, different religions, they speak about this kind of speech, what this kind of experiences, and they have some shared and common kind of grounds or experiences in these sort of out of body, we can say, experiences. So then it is of course a proof. It's a kind of even scientific sort of evidence.
Yes. So up until now, we came to the conclusion that a human being has got, as far as we know, has got two dimensions, the physical part and the metaphysical part, which is the soul. And we agree upon that fact. Now, the question is, the experience that these people have in their life, a sort of virtual death before the actual death, and they have the chance to come back and retell their stories. How could we justify these experiences? Are they hallucinations? Are they illusions? Or they're just actual things?
Actually, we cannot call them illusions. They might be true and might not be true, because we cannot actually verify the experiences of others. I cannot verify and approve your own experiences, and you cannot exactly. do the same for me. So, but we, based on the, let's say, the knowledge that we have about the soul, and as you rightly actually concluded, that we believe that human body is actually made of two important parts and factors, body and soul. Let us say spirit and body. So, yes, the experiences of every person are unique for himself or herself, and nobody can actually ignore and improve it 100%, but they can be true, because based on the powers that human beings have and the spiritual powers that they have, as the brother referred to, the willing death, mot ikhtiyari, so people can go and experience these things before mutu qabla anta mutu. When we are asked, based on the Islamic recommendations, mm-hmm. try to die before you are going to be dead.
Before the actual death.
But on the title that you have actually selected for that, I am a little bit doubtful to call it a virtual death or, let's say, actual death. This cannot be called a virtual, because this is also a real and actual transition to the other world, but it's not a complete yes. one.
Then it's safer to put it this way, that... Yeah. In a time of a kind of disease or sickness that might lead into inactivity of the brain?
Even not that form, because, you know, sometimes we can do it while we are quite safe and we are quite healthy.
Like the mystics do.
Even not non-mystics can experience the same thing.
Now it's very complicated.
Yeah, so everyone can have this experience. Mm-hmm. So, but... To say that this experience is true or not, we cannot judge.
But for sure, in those moments, the brain is inactive.
The brain is inactive because, you know, brain is, as the brother said, is a material part. And physical part of yes. the body. But whatever is going to... our experiences comes from our souls.
Yes.
So the experience that we are talking about in this show is just our spiritual experiences.
Yes, spiritual.
So they can come to everyone. Mm-hmm. A person who is a sick person or a person who is fully healthy. And to everyone that comes in any time and in any era can happen to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been advised by Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagh, the peak of eloquence, to think of death before you die. And you see, throughout the Nahj al-Balagh, we see lots of recommendations of Imam, that Imam very delicately and accurately defines how this transition is going to happen. And when we think about these recommendations, something might even come to the pupil when you think too much about something
yes.
that come. It might even come to yourself.
Yes, yes.
See, and
that's why some people call it illusion, because they yeah. say you think too much about something, you focus upon it, and that mm-hmm. happens to you.
Yeah, I've heard in the biography of Sayyid Ayatollah Sayyid Al-Qadi rahmatullah alayh, that he once asked that. He has been asked about such issues, that where do you know these issues, and where did you experience such things? He said, while I was in graveyards and studying Nahj al-Balagha, and those phrases of
it's
Imam.
Very interesting.
Those phrases of Imam about the death and reminding the life after this life.
That's going into the depth of each line.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. We have to have a very wrap-up situation in which I will tell you that we're speaking of death and the separation of the soul from the body. And we talked about some very interesting stuff. Thank you for listening to us.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside, I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Gun enthusiasts protest that now is the time for mourning, not politics, for national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. The article you're about to hear has been written by Nicholas Kristof, a former New York Times opinion columnist. Nicholas Kristof was a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor of Oregon this year. The piece is titled, "These Gun Reforms Could Save 15,000 Lives. We Can Achieve Them." Gun enthusiasts protest that now is the time for mourning and not politics, for national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. But we're tired of commemorating gun violence in America only with thoughts and prayers. We didn't respond to the 9/11 attacks only with moments of silence, or to Pearl Harbor just with lowered flags and memorial services. No, we resolved to act, even though these were hard challenges with no perfect solutions. Gun policy is likewise complicated and politically vexing, and we're not going to make everyone safe. Still, experts suggest that over time, we plausibly could reduce gun deaths by a third, or 15,000 lives saved annually, with a series of pragmatic limits on firearms and those who can get them. Instead, we're paralyzed in ways that threaten our democracy and our well-being. American children and American teenagers are 57% more likely to die young compared with children and teenagers in other advanced countries. And guns are one important reason. One study found that Americans aged between 15 and 19 are 82 times more likely to be shot dead than similarly aged teenagers in our peer countries. Let's just acknowledge that what we're doing isn't working, and we need new approaches. So what's a way forward? This will be painful for many of my fellow liberals, but I suggest that we work harder to engage centrists, talk about gun safety rather than gun control, and jump into the weeds. Social scientists suggest complexifying an issue to reduce polarization, and sure enough, I find that I can sometimes have productive conversations with gun enthusiasts if we focus on technocratic details. For example, consider the minimum age to buy or possess a gun. The suspects in both the Uvalde, Texas and Buffalo, New York shootings were only 18 years old, and that's not surprising. Americans aged between 18 and 20 account for 4% of the population, but 17% of those known to have committed a murder. In Wyoming, one of the most pro-gun states in America, the minimum age to buy a handgun is 21. Overall, one-third of states limit purchase of a handgun to those who are age 21 or older, according to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. If we say that teenagers can't buy alcoholic drinks, isn't it worth having a conversation about whether they should be able to buy Glock 19 handguns and AR-15-style rifles? One study found that 17% of all firearm offenders obtained guns legally, but would not have been able to do so if their state required handgun purchasers to be at least 21. Even more would have been ineligible to buy guns if there had been limits imposed on those with drug and alcohol convictions. That's another conversation to have. We typically don't allow people with felony convictions to possess firearms. And wouldn't it also make sense to bar purchases by someone with a recent misdemeanor conviction for drug or alcohol abuse, for violence, or for stalking? Only 10 states bar people with stalking convictions from buying guns. We know that people going through breakups are particularly at risk to themselves and to their ex-partners. So why not pass red flag laws that allow guns to be removed from someone who is undergoing a mental health crisis or subject to a domestic violence protection order? Even former President Donald Trump has backed red flag laws. What about universal background checks to buy a firearm? Opinion polls suggest that gun owners themselves overwhelmingly favor universal background checks. Yet 22% of firearms are obtained without them. In much of America, there is a more thorough review of people adopting a rescue dog than of those buying assault rifles. And should we really continue to allow people on the no-fly list to buy firearms but not board a plane? These are pragmatic steps that won't eliminate gun violence or avert every shooting incident, but they can make our country a bit safer. And while they will feel flimsy and unsatisfactory to many, they would at least break the paralysis on sensible gun policy. They would indicate that some progress is possible at a time when gun-related deaths have been worsening. 19 elementary school children died in the Texas school shooting on Tuesday, 24th of May, along with two teachers. 9 days earlier, six people were shot in a California church, one fatally, and five were shot, two fatally, at a Texas flea market. A day before that, a gunman killed 10 people in a racist attack on black shoppers in Buffalo, New York. When New Zealand experienced a mass shooting in 2019, that country acted in just 26 days to tighten gun laws. But here in America, it has been 56 years since one of the first gun massacres, the University of Texas Tower shooting in 1966, that claimed the lives of 17 people. Yet we know that gun safety is not a hopeless task, because just about every other country manages to do better. The Onion's satirical website regularly responds to mass shootings with the headline, "No way to prevent this," says only nation where this regularly happens. It has a point. The result of our paralysis is that just since 1975, more Americans have died from guns, including suicides, murders, and accidents, than in all the wars in United States history, going back to the American Revolution. Is the Second Amendment an obstacle? Perhaps to some degree, but most of us, judges included, recognize that we need some limits on weapons. Few believe that private citizens should be able to possess mortars, or that it's okay for 15-year-old teenagers to buy assault rifles. The practical question is a difficult one of where precisely to draw the lines. The truth is that we're not going to ban guns in the United States any more than we're going to ban alcohol, motorcycles, hunting knives, cigarettes, or other products that can be deadly. Screaming maximalist fights about gun control versus the Second Amendment have created a political stalemate as we continue to lose 45,000 lives a year to gun violence. That's 123 lives lost in a single day. This does not happen in other countries. Japan typically loses a single-digit number of people to gun murders in a year. We lost twice that in a single school shooting incident on Tuesday. Whenever I write about guns, I get indignant protests. Cars kill about as many Americans a year as guns do, but you don't ban cars. No, but we do work to make vehicles safer. Auto safety is a boring, non-politicized endeavor driven by engineers that has enabled us to live with dangerous objects, that is cars, and reduce the auto fatality rate per 100 million miles driven by more than 90% of the population since 1923. Likewise, we have a non-politicized safety process for ladders, swimming pools and toys. 8 pages of federal regulations on ladders, which kill around 100 people a year, with safety campaigns including making March Ladder Safety Month. Why can't we take a similar evidence-based approach to guns, not aiming for mass confiscation, but for reducing the carnage? For example, we require a license to operate a car, so why not a license to buy a gun? That's the law in Massachusetts, which has one of the lowest gun mortality rates in America. And while Massachusetts is a liberal state where one might expect tighter gun laws, permits are also required through a simpler process to buy a handgun in North Carolina. Texas had such a requirement, but last year approved a new law ending the mandate for a license to carry a handgun. Addressing gun violence must also include a strong mental health component, as the military recognizes in its strategy to reduce suicides. Likewise, social programs like Cure Violence and Becoming a Man aren't specifically about guns, but do appear to reduce gun violence. There are many other steps that we can take. Safe storage requirements for firearms keep guns from children and thieves. Some 380,000 guns are stolen annually from private owners in the United States. We need to crack down on ghost guns assembled by the purchaser from parts without a serial number or any background checks. We must curb the next technology, firearms made by 3D printers. Let's be driven by evidence, which means more research. What about voluntary gun buybacks to reduce the pool of 400 million guns already in America? What about warning labels and guns, cautioning that a firearm in the house increases the risk of a gun death? What about a tax on guns to cover some of the external costs of their misuse, just as we tax cigarettes? What about universal background checks to buy ammunition? How about waiting periods or a limit of 2 gun purchases a month per person? How about a crackdown on straw purchasers who equip gangs? America is losing ground to guns. An estimated 18.8 million firearms were sold in the United States last year. The United States already has the highest number of firearms per capita by far. Yemen, in the midst of a civil war, ranks second. American civilians appear to have more assault weapons, the civilian versions, than the United States military has of the automatic version. So spare us the pious calls to avoid politics. Rather, let's supplement thoughts and prayers with concrete steps based on nerdy evidence gathering, based on hard conversations with people we disagree with to reduce gun deaths so that elementary schools need not be graveyards.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.